On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Linda Douglas in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Bob Schrum has come to embody the age of political consultants. Over the past 30 years, he has become one of the most sought-after Democratic campaign gurus, advising most recently both Al Gore and John Kerry. But the campaign losses of his career have prompted some soul-searching. Now Bob Schrum is making concessions and confessions. He's also telling juicy insider stories. This hour, On Point, Bob Schrum and the dishy political details. Joining me now in the studio is Bob Schrum, the political consultant to more than 30 winning Senate races and 8 losing presidential campaigns. Everyone from George McGovern and Ed Muskie, Ted Kennedy, Al Gore, John Kerry. He's written some of the defining Democratic speeches of our time, and now he's out with a new pot-boiling, dishy memoir, No Excuses, Concessions of a Serial Campaigner. Welcome, Bob Schrum.
Happy to be here. I'm not sure that I would call it dishy. I think it's frank and honest. It's honest about the things I think I did wrong, and it's honest about the political figures I write about, because I think they are much more interesting as human beings than as stick figures or papier-mâché images moved across a political soundstage, which is how we see them most of the time.
Well, what I think is one person's frank account would be another person's dish, simply because most of us have never seen the inside of a political campaign and the way that you describe all the details, the way that words are poll tested, the way that ideas are tracked through focus groups, the way that consultants argue about how to package a candidate and package the candidate's message. You were considered one of the great masters of this art form, the evolving art form of the consultant world. And there was a period in the 2004 presidential campaign, let's start there, the most recent one, that was called the Schrum primary. What was that?
I hated it. It was that four of the people I had worked for were all thinking of running for president and were going to run for president, as it turned out. And there could have been a fifth, Al Gore. And so someone in the press decided to write about the Schrum primary. I think that was because there wasn't much else to write about that was significant. I didn't like it much. James Carville and I talked about this because it had happened to him after we were entering 1992, and people wrote about the Carville primary, about who he was going to work for. He didn't like it. I mean, it makes you uncomfortable. Look, we've entered an age where people know who political consultants are. They actually get known. It was starting with Theodore White in 1960. The curtain got pulled back, and people saw at least a little bit of what went on inside. But that wasn't something I felt particularly happy about.
Then, as the
I actually think, by the way, that the Schrum primary and the Schrum curse, in terms of presidential campaigns, are both equally invalid. First, I believe that Al Gore won in the year 2000. And second, while I'm very proud that I worked for George McGovern and quite grateful because a lot of the people who worked for Richard Nixon went to jail, I'm not sure that when I was his speechwriter in 1972, I was actually responsible for the outcome of a campaign that I don't in any event think we could have won.
You mentioned the Schrum curse. That is what happened. That was what the label became by one of the writers for one of the newspapers during the much troubled John Kerry presidential campaign of 2004. What was the Schrum curse?
Well, in theory, the Schrum curse was that if I worked for someone for president, they didn't win. Or if I was in charge of the campaign, they didn't win. I wasn't in charge of all those campaigns or wasn't the strategist in all 8 of those campaigns. But I will take my responsibility. There were some mistakes that we made. I think it was a terrible mistake to go into Bob Kerry's campaign, the senator from Nebraska, in 1992. Only a few weeks before the New Hampshire primary, give him a foreign trade message he didn't believe in, and he made an ad to camera, which was actually having some impact in New Hampshire, was moving votes in his direction until he denounced his own ad. I mean, he is the only existential politician I ever met in my life, as I write in the book. Does he contradict himself, as Walt Whitman said? Fine. He's perfectly happy with that. So I guess that's what the Schrum curse is supposed to be. I've done 9 or 10 campaigns overseas that have elected presidents or prime ministers. I just wish I could have imported it back to the U.S.
When you say you gave Bob Kerry a message that he didn't believe in. Is that what consultants do?
It's not what they should do because it doesn't work. I remember, and I write about this in No Excuses, when I got hired by John Corzine, who was the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, who was going to run for the United States Senate in New Jersey in 2000. And I went to the first meeting, and there was a poll, and the poll presented him as a kind of slightly right-of-center, business-oriented Democrat. And he looked at it, and he said, "This isn't me." He said, if this is what I want to run for big things and big changes, and if I'm not doing that, then I'll just go open a hedge fund or do something else on Wall Street. And we sent the pollster back to the drawing board with the real John Corzine, who turned out to be very appealing to the electorate.
This whole discussion is going to be peppered with discussions and questions about whether or not candidates did believe the things that they were saying all the way throughout these various campaigns. But you made clear in this book that one thing that really troubled you by the end of the John Kerry campaign, the thing you felt may have hurt him the most, was his decision to vote in favor of giving the president authorization to use force in Iraq, to go to war in Iraq. Did John Kerry, in your view at that time, base that vote on political considerations? He was, after all, trying to fashion a national security profile to run for president.
No, I don't think he did. I think he, and I write about this as well, he got some advice, not from me, that if he didn't vote for it, then he could say goodbye to his chances to be president. I didn't agree. That advice, I think, was wrong in the sense that politically he had the national security credentials over a long period of time where I think he could have voted either way. I don't think anybody that I know voted on this war for political reasons. But when you hear the political argument, and if you worry about the political argument and you're trying to run for president, it can begin to reshape the lens through which you weigh the merits. So that by the time you get there and you're weighing the merits in what is for a lot of senators, I think, a close and difficult vote, it sort of shapes the lens through which you make that decision.
You really don't think that any of the candidates who were running for president based their votes on how it was going to affect them as candidates later on?
I don't think people consciously went to the floor of the U.S. Senate and voted on the war resolution on a political basis. I think the political arguments that they heard, the political considerations that bothered them, had a much bigger impact in terms of shaping the prism through which they examine the merits of the issues. I mean, it's the way human beings think. You know, people hear that certain decisions are going to have certain consequences, and, you know, over time that has an effect on the way they make judgments.
How did you pick John Kerry as the winner of what you hated having called the Shrum primary, but that's what it was called?
I thought that he was the best qualified person in the field to be president. I thought he had the best chance to beat President Bush. And although he gets no credit for it, he came very close to being the first nominee in history to defeat an incumbent president of his own party renominated in time of war.
John Kerry, as you write in the book, seemed to do the same thing that the prior Democratic candidate had done, and that was to continue to bring in more and more consultants, shifting groups of advisors as the campaign went through its many ups and downs, certainly an up when he won the primary nomination, but many downs as he careened through the general election. You write about a time when Kerry himself was interested in bringing in some people from Madison Avenue. The head of Chanel, he had a CEO there advising him. There was a flirtation with Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple. There were some Madison Avenue ad writers. There was an ad someone considered having to do with an elephant. Tell us about that.
No, it was a very creative idea that was proposed by the Madison Avenue people, which would have been an elephant going through a china shop, knocking over pieces of china as the narrator talked about Bush's impact on policies. The ad would have cost a great deal of money to produce. Should have been done probably by an independent committee or outside of the campaign, because we had made what I thought was the mistaken decision to accept federal funding. So it would have been an interesting ad. This happens in every campaign. I mean, in the Clinton campaign in 1992, there was a whole Madison Avenue unit, produced a number of ads. They were very expensive. They were tested, and they didn't work.
Do consultants actually help in that way by bringing in admin or by shaping images that may not have anything to do with the actual substance of the issues that are being discussed, but that paint a picture, almost like you're selling a product?
Product advertising and political advertising are very different in the following sense. If you, say, advertise an Apple computer in a creative and interesting way, and you move your market share from 5% to 7% or 15% to 18%, it can mean hundreds of millions of dollars. In a political campaign, at least a two-way one, you have to get to 50% of the vote. So it's a whole different process that you have to go through. The second thing is, and you got to give voters some credit for this, at least in terms of the positive advertising, voters actually, for the most part in my experience, want to see candidates talk to them. They want to get a sense of the candidate. Now, that's not always easy to do in 30 seconds, but that's what they want. I mean, the ad that saved George Bush's campaign in 2000 in the primaries against John McCain, as you'll recall, was him sitting on a bench outside of some building in South Carolina saying, "I'm a reformer with results." I mean, and it was just him talking to people.
I want to talk to you also about the Gore campaign. Interestingly, Gore said after his campaign was over, a campaign that was the loss of which was blamed on consultants, even though you make the point that many Democrats win, that it's hard to say Gore actually lost. Gore said that in retrospect, if he had to do it over again, he would just say what he thought and not listen to the polls. Would that have worked?
I think that's exact. In fact, when he did that for a period of time, we experienced the greatest gains of the entire campaign. We had gone out in June and had either a Progress and Prosperity tour or a Prosperity and Progress tour, trying to take credit for what had happened in the economy in the 1990s, and we went straight down in the polls because people gave Bill Clinton credit, they gave Alan Greenspan credit, they gave Bob Rubin credit. They didn't give a lot of credit to Al Gore, who they thought focused on the environment. And in a phrase I got blamed for, he started talking about a government that would work for the people, not the powerful. And I think that was authentically him. His old friend and my partner in 2000, Carter Eskew, they went back 30 years, describes him as most genuinely a futurist populist. And I think that's the Al Gore we see right now. And as he carried that message through the summer past the Lieberman pick, we took a dip after the Republican convention but stayed with it, came back in the convention speech. He went into that convention double digits behind. By the Saturday after the convention, he was 5 points ahead. At that point, there was a lot of pressure to take the edge off that message. He wrote a piece, I think it was either in the Washington Post or the New York Times after the election, saying that, defending the whole formulation of the people, not the powerful, and saying it's what he actually believed. I think it is what he actually believes. President Clinton called me, as I describe him in the book, the penultimate editor of the acceptance speech at about 6 in the morning on the day of the acceptance speech and said, "I hope there's not too much of that populist people, not the powerful stuff in there."
So there
was real pressure on that front.
Let's talk about Gore's convention speech and talk about it from the consultant's point of view in terms of what you actually had to do to massage that speech for public consumption. Why don't we just listen to a little bit of that?
We're entering a new time. We're electing a new president, and I stand here tonight as my own man, and I want you to know me for who I truly am.
You hear Al Gore say that he is standing there as his own man, which had a lot of meaning that certainly had to do with he wasn't Bill Clinton, and he was trying to be his own man. But what was interesting to me in your book was you describe how every sentence of that speech was put before a focus group.
A dial group, actually, where people turn the dials one way or another and let you know what's working and what's not working.
And is that how a speech like that is written?
Well, no, that's not how it was written. That's how it was tested. The original draft of the speech, as I write, was probably 12,000 words long. The final product was 5,700 words. There were things that worked and things that didn't work. But he knew what... I mean, the basic themes of that speech were actually crafted long before those dial groups ever occurred. The whole idea of him standing there as his own man and making himself not simply the vice president but a potential president. The whole notion of accepting the nomination in the name of the people, that he had met across the country who needed help with prescription drugs, help with jobs, help with education or health care. That was all there long before we did any testing. And but I don't understand why people would think. See, there's a difference between using polling or using dial groups to tell you what you believe and using polling or using dial groups to show you what the most effective way to make your case is. And that's all that happened there.
And that's what you were doing, in the latter
instance. Listen, Al Gore, look, I write about this, rather casually and not thinking about it. I think about it all the time now because I wish Al Gore had been president on 9/11. I wrote a sentence into the acceptance speech, something to the effect of, "We have news for Saddam Hussein. We're going to get even tougher on him. It's time for him to go." And Gore just took it out. Not because he himself wasn't tough, and not because, as you know, Linda, because you covered him, he wasn't a hardliner during the Cold War. He was. But because he's very prudent and careful about issues of war and peace. If he'd been president on 9/11, I think we would have had a massive number of troops into Afghanistan as fast as possible, would have cornered and captured Osama bin Laden in Tora Bora, and we never would have gone to war in Iraq.
Let's talk to Tom from New Haven, who actually wants to ask you a question about Gore's new book, The Assault on Reason. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, I'm sorry, Bob, I haven't read your book, but having just finished Al Gore's book, the first part of it really is a critique of the current administration and just how they've handled things. And Gore suggested it ought to be very different. And it seems to me that the whole Democratic Party ought to be trying something different in campaigning as well as policy approaches. But wouldn't a shift, some kind of big shift, be in order at this point for the Democrats, whether it be, you know, towards where Al Gore is suggesting or towards the Republican model, which seems to be real effective? Isn't it time for a serious change in the way we campaign in order to get different results?
Well, actually, I think the Republican and Democratic models in terms of consulting and organizing campaigns are pretty similar. Democrats hold a ritual beating of our defeated nominees afterwards, even if they win like Gore did. Republicans recycle theirs, whether it's Ronald Reagan or Richard Nixon. I mean, so we seem to think that we have almost an entitlement to win, so that people believe it was, for example, easy to beat George Bush in 2004. It was not easy to beat George Bush in 2004. It was a closely divided country where you were going to have a 50-50 election or close to a 50-50 election no matter what. And it was going to, in my view, in the end, be won or lost by a matter of inches. There was a story I love from about JFK after the 60 campaign where Time magazine called the campaign coruscatingly brilliant. He had a great sense of perspective, and he walked in and said to some of the people who had been involved in the campaign a few days later, "Well, change 60,000 votes and we're kind of coruscatingly stupid." On your second or your first point, I don't know which was your first or second, that the party needs to do something different, that's one of the arguments I make in the book. I don't think that the Democratic Party long-term might work in 2008 if that's what we do, because Bush has been so bad and the Republicans seem in such bad shape. I don't think the Democratic Party long-term can succeed, can matter, and if we win, can make a big difference unless we are actually willing to stand up for what we believe. One of the great strengths of Republicans, and one of the reasons they survived Goldwater, survived Nixon, got to the Reagan era, was that they constantly argued their conservative principles. They aren't principles in which I happen to believe, but they gave the country the sense that they had a set of beliefs. They actually persuaded people to share some of those beliefs and, most of all, convinced people that they stood for something. I think if Democrats can't stand up for economic and social justice in a really straightforward way, then what are we there for except to inherit power when the other side fails?
Mm-hmm.
I think, for example, on health care, we need to be able to talk to people about real national health reform, some kind of plan that will get health coverage to everybody. And it shouldn't necessarily be as complicated as all the experts we recruit make those plans. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll give you an example. Why aren't we saying we're for Medicare for all? And reassuring people by saying they can either have some form of Medicare or they can buy the private insurance they have today. I can tell you most people would move toward Medicare.
Well, Bob Schramm, some of the people who've reviewed the workings of the Kerry campaign, the workings of the Gore campaign, do exactly what you say Democrats do, and that is Democrats do tend to blame their losers, campaign losers, for a long, long time. Let's look at a couple of the things that did happen in the Kerry campaign. The one for which you take some responsibility certainly was the slow response to the so-called Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, the group that came out and challenged Kerry's status as a war hero. What happened there, and what did Kerry want to do?
Well, Kerry wanted to respond immediately. Look, no excuses doesn't mean no explanations. And while I take responsibility for the decision, it ought to be put in context. I wasn't the only one, by the way, who bears a share of that responsibility. We had made a decision after a very vigorous internal debate, and Senator Kerry made the decision, that we would accept federal funding for the general election. Karl Rove's most brilliant decision was not to put the Republican convention in New York, but to put it in September, because that meant that Bush had the same amount of money to conduct an 8-week campaign that we had to conduct a 13-week campaign. He also had the capacity in all of August to keep spending primary dollars, which we didn't once John Kerry had accepted the nomination. So when this decision was made, it was made with a conscious caveat that this meant we would be off television in the month of August. In the first week of the Swift Boat attacks, the polling showed it showed that nothing changed, actually. And in our own national tracking, we went up 2 points. We should have thrown all that out the window. Kerry's instinct was exactly right. My first instinct, if we hadn't had financial constraints, would have been to go back at this, go back at it instantly, and go back at it hard. As I said earlier, it's not that people think that I'm shy about negative campaigning. I one of the first races that I did as a political consultant was Alan Cranston's reelection campaign for Senate from California against a congressman named Ed Schau, who was young, attractive, tried to present himself as moderate, and almost all of that campaign was a negative attack on Schau.
And I should point out here, by the way, that you and I are old friends, having known each other back from that campaign, and I've watched all the campaigns that you've done since. And want to find out more about these details that you have exposed and revealed here in the book about the Kerry campaign. Let's talk a little bit about the vice presidential selection process. One thing you write in the book is that Kerry said later, after the campaign, that he wished he had never picked John Edwards. Why was that?
I think that he believed that Edwards was not. I think two things. First, I think he believed that he was not as effective as he might have been at going after Bush and Cheney. But secondly, I think he thought that, and I'm speculating about this because I didn't ask him. It's what I think. I think that he believed that maybe he should have picked Dick Gephardt, and that if he did, then maybe the institutional forces in Missouri would have given us a chance to carry that state. Now, we had polled on the vice presidential possibilities, and Edwards on paper in the polling looked like a stronger choice in Missouri than Gephardt. But if you pick somebody who has deep roots in the political culture of a state, there tends to be an effort in that state to try to carry it.
You also say in the book that there was some consideration given to picking Hillary Clinton. Why was she not chosen as the vice presidential nominee?
She didn't. She had relatively high negatives, and it didn't look like she would help the ticket. I'm not at all sure that she wanted the job. She was considered in the sense that she was in that list, and there was polling done on her. As a presidential candidate, she's in a different position, I think. She still has the negatives, but whoever the Democrats nominate, whoever the Republicans nominate, will end up with negatives somewhere between 40 and 45 by Election Day, just given the polarized nature of the political process now and the fact that the country itself is so closely divided, even though people are very angry with Bush about the war.
Going back to John Edwards for a moment, you worked for John Edwards, and at one point when you first met him, when he was thinking of running for the Senate in North Carolina, you phoned your partner and said you thought you'd met a future president of the United States. Why did you think that at the time?
I thought he was had a genuine populist streak, identified with the people, and I still believe this, identified with the people that he grew up with in Robbins, North Carolina. His father was a mill worker. And I thought he had an extraordinary capacity to communicate at a level that I had seen in very few political leaders.
Later on in the book, though, you write something which, as you know, has sparked anger from Edwards and his supporters. You write a story about how you urged him to vote for going to war in Iraq, to support the president's authorization of the use of force in Iraq, even though he appeared, in your perception, to be uncomfortable with that decision. Is that what happened, and was that his fault if he wanted to vote against going to war in Iraq but did not?
Well, first of all, it wasn't a happy thing for me to write, because it's one of the pieces of advice that I gave over the years that I most regret. I think that the war in Iraq is the greatest foreign policy disaster in my lifetime, and it's done enormous damage to the U.S. I also think the political calculation was wrong. That's what happened. But as with John Kerry, by the way, I don't believe that John Edwards went to the Senate floor and consciously voted for something he didn't believe in. I also think that it's preposterous to assume that people who are considering running for president aren't going to contemplate the political consequences of the decisions they make. I mean, there's a kind of Casablanca notion here that people are shocked that there's politics happening. Ronald Reagan, when he was president, and I don't think anybody would deny, whatever they thought of him, that this was someone with deep convictions, had polls taken virtually every night. They had a rolling polling program taken every night. Bill Clinton, as president, polled on almost every major proposal and decision that he made, you know, unless there was some crisis in which he had to react immediately. So I'm a little mystified by the fact that people think that somehow or other there's something wrong with saying, what's the political consequence of this?
We got a response from the Edwards campaign. You know, he has been upset about this telling of this story, which says, and I'll quote here, Senator Edwards has said he was wrong to vote for the war in Iraq, but he made his decision based on information from a number of sources, including the Senate Intelligence Committee briefings and conversations with former high-ranking Clinton administration national security officials, not based on political advice from Bob Shrum or anyone else. Is he right?
Well, I don't know how he thinks he ultimately made his decision. If that statement, and it's very carefully worded, actually, if you listen to it, he did discuss the political consequences of the vote with me and with several other people. He sort of owned up to this at one point when he said what he learned from the whole episode was to put more trust in his own judgment. But I don't know that people – I don't know that you can sell people a goody-two-shoes notion of how political leaders make their decisions.
We're talking with Democratic consultant Bob Shrum about his impressions of the new slate of candidates and about his new memoir, No Excuses, Concessions of a Serial Campaigner. Just to go back to what you've written, because it's also interesting, let's talk about the Gore campaign once again and what appeared to be a conscious decision by Al Gore and you advising him not to campaign on the record of Bill Clinton or with Bill Clinton at his side, understanding, of course, that it was in the wake of the Monica Lewinsky scandal. But why was that decision made?
Well, the decision was made based on some very hard and compelling data, which showed that among soft and undecided voters, President Clinton's positive negatives were in bad shape. The country had a case of cognitive dissonance about Bill Clinton. They thought he'd been a good president, but in terms of his personal ratings, they were disturbed about what their kids had heard sitting in front of television sets. We discovered in focus groups that if you talked about a third Clinton term, the soft and undecided voters recoiled from it. I remember I got a phone call the weekend before, which I write about, from Tom Harkin, the senator from Iowa, for whom I had worked, who said, you have to send Clinton here. And he was very exercised and basically left the impression that if we didn't make that decision, somehow or other I might never work for him again, which I did. I just went through the data with him and asked him not to get it out there, because the truth was we had enough tensions with the White House at that point anyway.
Was it a mistake to campaign with Clinton?
Oh, no. I mean, look at Iowa. His Clinton's favorable unfavorable was 39-47. The focus group comments were devastating. Among soft and undecided voters, his favorable unfavorable was worse. When I got through all the data, Harkin said to me, well, could you maybe send out Joe Lieberman for one more visit? And that's what we did, and we carried Iowa by 1 point. There's a kind of urban legend that somehow or other the country was really anxious to reelect Bill Clinton in 2000. Now, I happen to like him, to admire his political skills. He's the rock star of the Democratic Party. His tragedy is that he never got to be a great president. He got very close, for example, with the Mideast peace agreement if he'd gotten health care. But in 2000, it went both ways. He was an asset and he was a liability. And this, by the way, wasn't just me. It was Bill Daley, who had been in his cabinet and who was now the chairman of the campaign. Tad Devine, Donna Brazil, none of us disagreed with this decision.
Mm-hmm. What happened to Gore on the night of that first debate where you thought, and others at the time, that he might have won on points, but it turned out that the public was led to believe and came to believe that he lost? What happened?
Well, what happened was that in the practices, we talked about not reacting to Bush, not invading Bush's space, not getting into any kind of conflict with the moderator, and somehow or other, the vice president seemed to take that as a to-do list. But when I look back on it, I'm amazed. I mean, you have to be in awe of the capacity to spin something away from its substance. And I give the Republicans credit for this. What happened to Gore was that people decided that he had sighed in the debate. The issue became that he sighed. You know, and it's on Saturday Night Live, he sighed. There's something else he did, which I'll talk about in a second, that's my fault. And I look back on it and I say, wouldn't it have been better to have a president who sighed in a debate than a president who lied us into a war? I think sometimes we make decisions on the basis of very small and irrelevant things. The other thing that happened in that debate was, in practice, the first time he in terms of Social Security, he used the phrase lockbox. Only once or twice, I said, you have to make sure you really hit that phrase. I forgot that Gore only has two speeds, 10 miles an hour and 100 miles an hour. So I used the phrase lockbox six or seven times, and it became an immediate Saturday Night Live classic.
Let's bring in now Mayor, who is calling from Beaufort, South Carolina, who has a question for you. Mayor, go ahead.
Hi, Linda. It's Beaufort, South Carolina.
Sorry.
My question is, it's a comment, really, Mr. Shrum. You said that the problem with Democrats is they don't communicate their ideas and whatnot, and I don't think that's it at all. The problem is they do not have a unified message like the Republicans do. No matter how ridiculous the point is, no matter how stupid Clinton did it, Souter didn't really do anything wrong, Clinton did it, they all say the same thing. At the same time, it becomes part of the public consciousness, whereas the Democrats haven't learned to master that through their outlets. And I don't understand why it's taking them so long to figure that out.
It's hard to have a unified message unless you have a presidential candidate and a president. That's why the Republicans have had one, although it's now falling apart for them. I mean, if you look at the Republican presidential process right now, it's all over the lot, and there's a lot of despair and a lot of concern. Your general point I agree with. I mean, Democrats ought to stand up for a set of beliefs, ought to consistently fight for those beliefs, and ought to give the country the sense that they will. Not only because I think those beliefs are compelling. I think if Al Gore had stayed populist, for example, had talked more about the people, not the powerful, in the general election, he might have had a chance to carry Missouri and West Virginia, where his problem was guns and the solution was not to soft-pedal his position on guns.
And now we have another question coming from Carol, who's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Go ahead, Carol.
Hi, Linda. My question, there's a recent article in The Nation magazine that suggests that polling suggests that the electorate is actually more progressive, and the Democrats have been running really moderate campaigns. Do you think there really is, it's time for a more progressive campaign?
More progressive campaign. What do you think, Bob?
I've always thought that. In fact, I've been criticized for thinking that and for pushing that. The last 3 or 4 weeks of the Kerry campaign, after he won the three debates against Bush, he ran a very progressive campaign. I think it was what he really believed. I think it was the right thing to do. I've already said the biggest gains Al Gore made came when he was doing that. I don't think a strategy of tactics, waiting for the Republicans to fail, is the way forward for Democrats.
Well, on the subject of progressive campaigns, that was indeed your background. You're right that later on in more moderate campaigns, you were criticized for that. But you worked as a speechwriter. That was really the work you did before you got into consulting for Senator Edward Kennedy, who in 1980 challenged the incumbent Democratic President Jimmy Carter in a fight that you and he and certainly the others involved in that campaign really called a fight for the soul of the Democratic Party at the time. Let's just hear a little bit of the speech that he gave, which really, as it turned out, was his farewell to Democratic presidential campaign politics for him, given at the 1980 convention.
For me, a few hours ago, this campaign came to an end. For all those whose cares have been our concern, the work goes on, the cause endures, the hope still lives, and the dream shall never die.
The dream shall never die, and Ted Kennedy over the years has given you credit for writing those very memorable lines. Is the dream in your mind for Democrats the dream of liberalism? Because you do seem to write in the book that liberalism is dead in the Democratic Party.
Well, no. What I write in the book is that we've allowed the Republicans to poison the word. In 1960, the good word was liberal. John Kennedy got up and said, I'm proud to be a liberal. The bad word was conservative. Richard Nixon, as far as I know, never uttered that word in 1960. The dream is of a party that will stand up and fight for its basic beliefs. In my mind, the Democratic Party exists for the idea that government should not be on the side of the most powerful people, the most influential people, the people who are best off. Government ought to be an engine for opening up opportunity, for standing up for consumers, for standing up for ordinary people. I mean, that's the kind of life I've lived. My father was a tool and die maker. He took us to California to try and find a better education for my sister and myself. And I, you know, through debate and then I got some scholarships, I ended up going to two of the great universities in this country and through some other breaks ended up at the center of progressive politics for over 30 years. I want other people to have that chance. That's what I think the Democratic Party has to be about.
The two presidents who were Democrats in our lifetime, Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton, have come out for criticism by you in the book for not sticking to the principles that you just outlined here. You say in the book that Bill Clinton laid no foundation for future Democratic victories. Why was that?
Well, because there wasn't a set of ideas that emerged from the presidency. It was a successful managerial presidency, brilliantly successful at the economic level and in terms of reducing the budget deficit. But that can't be an enduring achievement that creates the kind of legacy that people who come after you can draw from, because as we've seen with George Bush, you can turn that surplus into a deficit very fast. In a lot of ways, the Democratic Party is still living off the legacy of a president who has been dead for almost 44 years. I mean, the amazing cover of Time magazine recently of JFK saying the lessons that we should all learn from John Kennedy.
And some of the more moderate candidates who have come out for come under criticism by you in the book are people such as Joe Lieberman. And you single him out in a couple of interesting ways in the book for things that happened during the Gore campaign, the first of which was his performance in the debate with Dick Cheney. You felt that he wasn't tough enough. Do you think that that contributed in any way to the lack of success that was experienced in the Gore campaign?
Well, when you only win by 500,000 votes in the popular vote and you only in Florida, you know, it's a couple hundred votes that are in dispute because the butterfly ballot enabled thousands of liberal Jewish voters to apparently cast their votes for Pat Buchanan. They obviously were trying to vote for Gore. When an election's that close, everything matters. What was stunning in that debate was when Lieberman looked at Cheney, who had been president of Halliburton, and said, you've done pretty well yourself during the Clinton years. And Cheney then said, with a lot of chutzpah, well, of course, I've been out in the private sector. It has nothing to do with government. Well, of course, Halliburton was making a fortune off government contracts. And I thought, now Lieberman's really going to clock him. And instead, Lieberman made some comment that he could see his wife, and she thought maybe she wished he was out in the private sector, too. And Cheney said, that's what we're trying to help you do. It was a terrible moment in that debate.
And then you also blame Lieberman.
By the way, let me say, I want to make clear, I think Bill Clinton, who got elected in 1992 on the slogan Putting People First, proposed to raise taxes on the wealthy, and ran for national health care, is a pretty good model for what Democrats ought to be thinking about now.
You also mentioned Lieberman and the decision that he made to call for the military ballots that were not postmarked and were sent in late to be counted in Florida during that very tight recount of the votes in Florida in the race between Bush and Gore. Do you think that Lieberman's decision to call for the counting of those military ballots might have given the presidency to George Bush?
Sure, although Florida officials might have decided to do it anyway, or maybe the Supreme Court would have voted 5-4 that they had to be counted. I mean, what really happened, the Supreme Court issued a decision that is almost without precedent in its history, because it began by saying this decision has no value and provides no guidance for future actions of the court. It's for this case only. I mean, they acted like a ward committee and by a one-vote margin gave the presidency to Bush.
Let's go now to Sally, who is calling in from New Haven, Connecticut. Sally, you're on the air.
Hi, Linda. Thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead.
Great. Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. It follows on a lot of the themes that have been spoken about already. My ideal candidate in the party right now is John Edwards, and it's for a pretty simple reason, which is that he represents, I think, a real alternative to, you know, unregulated free market capitalism. He has a kind of economic alternative, and yet he often gets kind of smeared by the mainstream of the Democratic Party and by kind of Democratic pundits for the big dirty words of protectionism and populism. I personally think that this is really a belief that the Democrats could win on, and that really it's their kind of ideological obligation to stop being so tightly in bed with corporations and with free market capitalism.
I think that I've thought for over a year that, and said it, that John Edwards was a serious candidate for president, one of the people who had the strongest chance to win. It is remarkable. He started off as a DLC Democrat. He's now much more a populist Democrat.
And do you think that populism is going to be a hallmark of the presidential campaign that's going to be waged by the Democrats this time?
Yeah, I use the word populist, and I use it in the book with a caveat that it covers too many things. And I wish we had a different phrase for it. I wish we just said liberal, progressive, you know. That's what Democrats ought to be about. I think it will be. I think you're going to not have a Democratic nominee who doesn't stand up for a real health care plan, as we've seen. You're not going to have a Democratic nominee who doesn't stand up for getting the U.S. out of Iraq. You're not going to have a Democratic nominee who doesn't stand up for doing something about outsourcing. Although outsourcing, for me, is a symbol of a problem, which is the inequality and stagnation of middle-class incomes. It's not the entire cause. In fact, it's not even the major cause of the problem.
Let's talk about the field for a minute, and let's talk about one particular development in the field of Republicans versus Democrats, and that is that the Democrats are raising so much money. This brings us back to what money means and what professional campaigning means and what the hiring of people to help you in your professional campaign may mean. Does the fact, for example, that Barack Obama has raised such an astronomical amount of money mean that he will be able to hire people like you, people who can give advice about how to run a campaign and win that campaign, or does it take something else?
No, it takes something else. He has terrific people. David Axelrod, who is his principal strategist and ad maker, is not only one of the best people in the business, he's also one of the more decent human beings I met in my life. And David Plouffe, who's his campaign manager, is someone that I first recommended in a New Jersey Senate campaign in 1996 for his first job as a campaign manager. That $32 million means that he's going to have the capacity to organize and communicate. But in the end, what will matter is what he communicates. I have this theory that I write about in the book that on January 1st, people in Iowa and New Hampshire and now the other early states get up and say, okay, we played around all year. We've gone shopping. Now let's get serious. And the question I thought they were going to ask in 2004, and the one they did ask, was who's a believable president who might have a chance to beat Bush? Kerry was there to meet them. This year, the question they're going to ask about Obama is there substance and depth to go with the excitement? The question they're going to ask about Hillary Clinton, who looks like the establishment candidate in a year of change, is does she stand up for change in ways that they really care about? And John Edwards is kind of in the position that Dick Gephardt was. He has to win Iowa. If he wins Iowa, he's off to the races. If he loses Iowa, I think he's out of the race.
And finally, just a very quick question. John McCain, who's losing money and not able to raise money, is he finished?
You can never say someone's finished. I mean, I was involved with John Kerry in a campaign that was written off as dead. I think John McCain's problem is he did everything he could to get the Republican establishment on his side, and when he got weak, they just started abandoning him.
I'm Linda Douglas in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.